from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Dan's a fireman and says there's nothing quite like standing inside a burning building. Kyle is an EMT who does search and rescue. Recently, he went looking for a missing autistic child. Those are the worst days, he says, looking for children. Art is a paramedic who once got bitten by an HIV-positive woman he was called to help. It made for a restless few weeks, he says. And Delia, another paramedic, says, sometimes I cry and cry, but it's an honor to be with people in the hard times as well as the good times. Delia, Art, Kyle, and Dan. They're first responders, and they join us as part of our In My Experience series. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When Art Sia was a pre-med student, he told his dad he wanted to be a paramedic instead. His dad wasn't happy. Sia became a paramedic anyway. Delia Stoltz works the back roads of rural California. Sometimes she helps deliver a baby. More often, she has to deal with death. I cry and hug, she says, but I don't disengage. Den Robertson is a 23-year veteran of the Oakland Fire Department who says he's been scared to death, distraught beyond words, but nothing, he says, feels better than putting yourself out there and doing good. Carl Barber is a 24-year-old EMT who volunteers on the side in search and rescue missions. He just got done searching for a missing autistic child. Why do Kyle, Dan, Delia, and Art do what they do? What does it take to not only face what most of us would rather avoid, but get there first to do it? They are all first responders, and they join us this morning as part of our In My Experience series. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Let's go around the room once. Each of you just introduce yourself, if you would. Art?
Thank you. So my name is Art Sia, and I play a bunch of different roles, but I most closely identify as a licensed paramedic.
Delia.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I am Delia Stoltz, and I'm a 911 transporting paramedic.
Hi, I'm Dan Robertson. I'm a career firefighter with the Oakland Fire Department, and I'm also the president of IFF Local 55 Oakland Firefighters.
And I'm Kyle Barber. I'm a field member of the Bay Area Mountain Rescue Unit, an all-volunteer wilderness search and rescue unit.
Thank you all for being here and for telling your stories as part of our In My Experience series. I want to start with just asking you, what gets you up in the morning and why you do what you do? Some of you have been through career changes. This is all very much a chosen profession, life's work for all of you, from young to veterans. So, Delia Stoltz, what gets you up in the morning? Why do you do what you do?
Oh, gosh, that would be hard to narrow down to one thing. I love that when you're a first responder, you never know what's going to happen when you go to work. I'm really passionate about caring for people. I love connecting with my patients. I love my coworkers. I like driving fast with my lights and my sirens. Yeah, there's honestly kind of too much to list. It's a great job to wake up for.
What is it about that that allows you to stay with it, even when times are tough? You have to deal with a lot of difficult things.
Well, you mentioned in the intro that my particular way of handling it is not to disengage. And that makes me a little anomalous in my profession because I think most of my colleagues are a little bit more better at compartmentalizing. They tend to kind of develop a little bit of separation from themselves in the calls. And for whatever reason, I feel happier when I'm more engaged emotionally. And for me, that means accepting the sad parts of the job and feeling it. And so far, I've never really had a burnout experience or a time where I had any aversion to the job. And I've been a paramedic for coming up on 8 years, and I've been in EMS around 10.
Tell me a story about how you contend with that, something that maybe happened to you recently when it was hard and tough, but you stayed engaged.
Well, recently I was on the scene of a full arrest. That's when somebody dies and 911 is activated. And In my response area, we don't tend to transport unless the person becomes salvageable, unless they regain a spontaneous pulse. And in this situation, that was not the outcome. And it fell to me to explain to family that the death had transpired, that there was nothing I could do about it, that I had done everything in my professional capacity. And as it was happening, more family members came because people were calling, because this is happening in a person's home. And at first, people were a little kind of upset with me. They had some concerns. They wondered what had happened. And I stayed with them. I explained it. I showed them my rhythm strips, the printouts of the pictures of the heart's electrical activity or lack thereof. And then I had to wait with the family until the sheriff coroner came. So I wound up being with this family for around 2 hours after this death, because the area that I respond is rural. And we wound up becoming very close. You know, we hugged. We talked about this person's life. They shared anecdotes. They offered me coffee and snacks. I didn't do that. I wasn't sure if that was professional or not. But it was beautiful. In the end, it was really beautiful. And I did shed a tear or two. And one or two family members did say that they appreciated that.
Yeah. How do you deal with that, Dan Robertson? Do you allow yourself to stay that in? Or do you find, after doing this for the decades that you have to develop a degree of separation?
Well, I think what works for me is to have a certain amount of, I like to call it professional detachment. So for me, there needs to be a way to kind of click it off. And then there's a process to unwind, you know, for when I get home and deal with my own family, my wife and my kids. But the situations do exist. You know, I've been in the exact same situations that Dahlia mentioned. And I think that, over the 24 years, I've gone through a lot of different ways to deal with it, some not so healthy, some more healthier than others. And I think at this point in my career, I've found what works for me. And that's to be able to have a little bit of a professional detachment and to be able to have some separation. And part of that goes with knowing that while I was on the scene, I did my best with all the training that I possessed in order to try to make a positive outcome for these individuals.
It's a job, though, I would think, Artsia, that it's very much a part of you. I mean, and you are dealing with life and death. I mean, we all care about our professions. We all deal with things that may be stressful. But, you know, stress for me is maybe mispronouncing someone's name. I mean, it's not what you contend with. So how do you wrestle with that?
Right. And it's interesting because life and death situations come up on occasion. It's not one of the more common things that we do. Much of what we manage as a paramedic or in EMS from the healthcare side is relatively almost mundane to a certain extent. And ironically, a lot of the stress comes from dealing with the mundane, because despite all of the training that we receive for all the critical side, we get very little training and we have very little infrastructure in place to manage the more mundane issues of chronic disease and injuries and social issues that we have to manage on a day-to-day basis. And for me as a paramedic, that's almost as stressful or even more so, because a lot of times I just feel helpless about that.
So in other words, if you're dealing with if you're called to help somebody who's maybe has a problem of chronic homelessness or chronic drug issues, you're seeing that person. You might see that person again and again, as I'm sure you did.
Two to three times a day.
Yeah.
You can literally see the same person in the same shift two or three times.
So the stress for you is thinking, what am I really doing? How am I helping?
What could I do to actually help this person leave that cycle of drugs, alcohol, homelessness, and try to deal with that? You know, we deal with the human condition. As in EMS and as first responders, we serve as the safety net for the healthcare system. So we provide you some form of healthcare, but often what we can provide is very ineffective for what you actually have as a problem. So
in some ways, Kyle Barber, is the and the rest of you, is it as painful as it is, there's a certain clarity to life and death in emergency situations. What Art is suggesting is something that's more perennial. Is it the clarity of sort of finding someone that's the most appealing, Kyle, as opposed to dealing with these perennial sorts of problems of someone who's chronically homeless?
I'm glad you asked that. I think that maybe when I got into search and rescue, what really appealed to me was this idea that I'd be rappelling out of helicopters or some sort of action movie hero sort of thing, where that moment of finding them and they're critical and you're going to save their life and it's sort of go, go, go. But the majority of what we do isn't like that. You know, the majority of what we do, you have to realize that on the trajectory of a search and rescue operation, it starts with me getting woken up in my bed and I don't know who I'm looking for or where they are. And it's going to start with our unit showing up at a command post. We still don't know where they are. We may not know what they look like. We may not know what their medical conditions are, what their clothing was, what their equipment was. We may not know anything about this person. And our search area may be California. We may be able to narrow it down to a national park or a region of a national park. So the vast majority of the trajectory of our operation is going to be physically walking through the wilderness looking for this person. The majority of it is not going to be dealing with someone in a traumatic situation. And usually the traumatic situation is resolved by the time that we've arrived. Mm. You know, it's resolved either because they've expired or it's resolved because they were never injured. They were just lost. So I think that as I've matured and as I've done search and rescue for more and more years, what's really appealed to me is not being a hero, which isn't what we do in my view. You know, what really appeals to me is I want to reunite people with their families, and it's that simple. And if that means doing something incredibly mundane and simple, then I'm more than happy to do it. And I'm more than happy to be woken up to do it.
We think, Dan Robertson, of these jobs. Kyle mentioned the word hero. You know, it's the childhood, I want to be a fireman when I grow up kind of thing, I guess. What is it that people don't understand about what being a fireman really means?
I never thought I wanted to be a fireman when I was growing up. So I just kind of – I stumbled upon the career in young adulthood. I think people don't understand the getting along with your fellow firefighters part, because we spend a lot of time in the fire station together.
Delia is nodding her head vigorously.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time in the fire station together, and – you have to get along, and you can't pretend you're someone else because they see you 24 hours a day. They see you when you're stressed out. They see you when you don't like the guy your daughter is dating. They see you when you're arguing with your wife. They see you in the middle of the night when you were asleep. If you're having a nightmare in the middle of the night, they hear you. My firehouse is old. We have an open dorm. So you hear when guys are snoring or passing gas in the middle of the night. You're very close, and you have to be able to get along and put the team aspect first.
And you work in a city that has lots of challenges, in a city that's had some tough times. And you also are in a very diverse city. And you're the first black president of the Firefighters Union in Oakland. How has that evolved over time? And in terms of getting along question, and is the firehouse a sort of microcosm in that way of the city itself?
Well, I think what I was struck by very early in my career while I was still on probation was – you either have a passion and a thirst for knowledge, for learning and doing the job well, or you don't. And amongst the career veterans I worked with early on, that was the trump card. That superseded any other issue. When I was brand new, I worked doing the same job as career firefighters, not supervisors, but my peer group doing the exact same job, who were World War II veterans. And that struck me at the time as something that was kind of, you know, odd but really cool at the same time. So as the job has evolved, I think the diversity is great. I really enjoy, you know, being able to go onto a call where, you know, if it's an EMS call and the patient and their family only speaks Vietnamese, if we have someone who speaks Vietnamese with us on the crew. You know, and I like the fact that when we show up, we reflect our community. And I think that's one of the pluses of the Oakland Fire Department.
Tell the story, if you would, Dan, of someone who you didn't get along with. You're talking about the importance of kind of getting along. There was someone I know that you worked with who you didn't get along with, and you wound up in the end being in a situation where you had to rescue that person.
Well, yeah, I had an issue with this gentleman, and in the firehouse, you tend not to let issues fester. You confront them head on, and you deal with them and move on, or you don't let things simmer, because, like I say, you're there all the time. You're there in stressful situations. It'll come out. Well, we had an issue, and to make a long story short, you know, as we were almost, you know, squared off, almost about to fight each other in the fire station, I was actually off duty, and I went to his firehouse to have this discussion with him. And I asked him directly, I said, we don't have to like each other, and we don't have to be friends. We don't even have to ever talk to each other. But sooner or later in the rest of our careers, at some point, we're both going to be on the same fire. And I'll be there for you, whether I like you or not. And I want to know that you'll be there for me. And the response I got was not really the response I was looking for. Some years later, we had a fire and there was a building collapse, and we actually lost a member that day. But this particular person was part of that crew who was trapped under the rubble of the burning building collapse. And I happened to be working at a fire station that day that was part of the rescue. So we made eye contact with each other, and in about 2 seconds inside this burning building, we made peace with each other.
What do you have to do this job well, Artsia? What is the quality you need? Listening to Dan's story makes me think about how you have to have these qualities of being able to deal with lots of different people. You have to be able to – you obviously have to have a certain degree of courage. You have to set things aside and do what needs to be done in the given moment. How else would you describe the qualities that you need to do what the four of you do?
Dan really put it out there as the drive to finish a mission, the drive to accomplish a goal. We're contrary to popular belief, most of us are not paid extremely well. Our benefits are fairly low. We have, in the EMS, we have a relatively short lifespan. Most folks don't make it past 10 years or so. And so it's to make it in the business is just understanding that you're here and that you're human, and the commodity we trade in is human, and that regardless of the severity of the situation, that you're going to drive to finish whatever that mission is. And it's the same in EMS as it is in fire service, in terms of that you identify with people who stay in the business for a while, and you find that the common theme is, regardless of whatever the small issues are at the end of the day, it's just that. They're just small issues. You know, the bigger issues that we serve our communities, that we serve people who need help regardless of whatever that might be. And we have to be able to provide it one way or the other. So creativity is a large part of that.
Tell me a good story, Delia Stoltz.
Boy, there's no pressure there.
I mean, a story that feeds you, that keeps you coming back.
Well, I love childbirth calls. I think you mentioned that in your introduction. I haven't had a lot of them, and I have had definitely one incredibly tough one that I wouldn't have minded not being on. It was a very, very, very difficult call. But I've also had a beautiful, beautiful experience where a mother on her way to the hospital, and again, the area where I serve is very remote, so you can be on the hospital on your way in the car to the hospital for quite some time. And I think the timing had just gotten a little off, so she found herself delivering. And so we were called when she realized this was going to happen, and we met her and her husband where they were. And as our ambulance stopped, we see the little car with the flashers, and as our ambulance stops, we barely, like, the ambulance barely stopped moving, and my intern and I that day are out the door. We're at her car, and her husband is holding this beautiful shiny, slimy, brand new baby girl that had just come out as our ambulance was decelerating. And he just had this white as a sheet look of shock and dismay and what just happened. And it was wonderful. It was like we could immediately see the baby was moving air. We could see that mom was moving air. Mom and baby both had good coloring. So we knew this wasn't a call where we were needed medically, that we were mainly just a safe transport to the hospital. And so I just talked to the mother, assessed the baby, dried the baby up. And what was funny is my EMT that day was a male and my intern that day was a male. And they were both like, oh, we're getting burnout on the estrogen on this call. But it was, I think, for mom, me and baby, it was just a beautiful experience. I was seriously high for 3 days on that experience. So that might be one of the happier end of the EMS spectrum calls.
Kyle Barber, I'm going to ask you to go in the other direction and describe a really hard experience, something that for you tested you, that stayed with you, that was challenging for you in terms of your ability to do this kind of work.
I think the natural instinct when faced with questions like that, and it's a common question that we get, you know, what's the most intense sort of story that you have, is to go to things that are really gory or trauma that you've seen or something like that. But for me, I find that what I really struggle with is when we're asked to search for people who've been harmed by other people. One of the calls that I can particularly think of, I was my second call in search and rescue. I was 17 at the time, and it was searching.
And you're doing this as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all volunteers. That was searching for Sandra Cantu, who many people may recall was a abducted 9-year-old girl or 8-year-old girl.
4 years ago, near Tracy.
Yeah, near Tracy. And my role in that search operation was to follow a canine through a hotel on one of the several assignments that I took. The canine was searching for any sort of blood or other bodily fluid that might have been left behind after an assault or murder. My job was to look for anything visually that the canine would be ineffective at picking up. And we went through this entire hotel room. Some of the other assignments that I did that day were, you know, searching parts of the community, abandoned houses, you know, that sort of thing. I didn't see anything, but it can certainly wear on you. It can be incredibly emotionally challenging to... You have to realize at the time you don't know if you're going to find this person. We did find Sandra Cantu and someone was convicted, but that uncertainty and the sort of emotional burden of trying to find that can be really challenging. On the flip side of that, something that I really want to point out, and I think that is really inspiring and that the Sandra Cantu story also attests to, is some 400 volunteers responded for incident after incident after incident, operational period after operational period during that call. All those people are volunteers. All of them have other jobs. They're everything from CPAs to engineers.
Want to hold you there because we have to leave for a break. And also just to clarify, the work that Kyle is doing in search and rescue is as a volunteer. All of our guests also are doing this work in paid capacities and for other organizations too. Kyle does both volunteer and paid work in this field. When we come back, we'll talk more about the challenges of this profession, the joys, the sorrows, the difficulties, the burnout, how you contend with this, what you've learned from it, what you've learned about the human condition from it. We'd like your thoughts and observations too. Join us if you'd like to join our conversation at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. More with our first responders when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, part of our In My Experience series, where we get to know the lives of people in their particular arenas. We're joined this morning by first responders, Dan Robertson, a fireman, Artsia, paramedic program director who teaches in this area, also a paramedic. Kyle Barber, who works as a volunteer for Bay Area Mountain Rescue Unit, also works as a EMT. And Delia Stoltz, a paramedic who works in a part of rural California south of Tracy. I'd like to hear your comments and thoughts about this topic as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786. We'll get those calls going in just a moment. But first, I want to hear, Dan Robertson, what it is like to be in the middle of a fire.
It's a lot of fun. It's really, you're in the moment, you're very focused, it's exciting, and it's one of those things that the books and the training can only get you so far. It's one of those types of jobs where experience really counts. And I was fortunate, you know, to work with some guys who looked at it as, I like to call them, they were journeyman firefighters who brought their lunch pail and punched the clock when the alarm went off. And you don't get too excited, but you're focused on your job, and it starts, you know, in Oakland, the 911 system, when you call to report a fire, a speaker in the firehouse comes on, so we'll actually hear your voice saying the address and saying what's on fire. So we'll start moving to the rig even before we're dispatched.
And is there still a little jolt of adrenaline you get when you hear that voice on the speaker?
Every time. Every time. And part of it is your mind starts working, and you're thinking about the address and whether you're going to be first in or second in, and the types of buildings in that area. Sometimes you know the exact building. Just last weekend I was at work and the address came in, and one of the guys says, oh, that's that abandoned Victorian that's boarded up in the middle of the block. And sure enough, it was the smoke was coming out of the abandoned Victorian in the middle of the block.
What's the scariest thing that's ever happened to you in a fire?
Typically, you don't think about it until afterwards. You're focused on doing what you're doing. There's been a couple of situations. Years and years ago, I was we had a grocery store on fire, and I was in a zero visibility condition. I entered the grocery store from the back, and I remember as I was, you know, making my way through the store in a zero visibility condition, all of a sudden I got really cold. And that's the opposite of what happens when you're searching for fire and on the end of a hose line. But when I got really cold, I realized, oh no, I'm in the freezer unit or the storage unit. And the thought that ran through my mind was, I'm going to run out of air. I'm going to die in here. They're going to make training videos about me, and everyone's going to laugh at me. And I didn't really worry about it too much at the time. We had a fire in another grocery store, ironically enough, and I was working on the ladder truck that day, so we were doing roof ventilation on this grocery store, and it was about 4:30 or 5 in the morning. And I remember later that morning at about 8:30 or 9 when we were back at the firehouse after cleaning up and drinking coffee, and the TV was on, and the TV news helicopter had footage of this building while we were on the roof. And I remember looking at this from the helicopter, seeing all these flames and these three guys walking across the roof, thinking to myself, man, those guys are crazy. What are they doing up there? And then it was like, oh, wait a minute, that was us. Yeah. You know, so typically the when you do get scared or when you do have those moments of fear, it comes later. And part of it is, I mentioned the whole team aspect. When you spend this time with your guys in the firehouse all the time and you get so close to them, your fear is you know, massaged or put away because you're not doing it by yourself. And if you're there with the three other guys that you work with, then you're not worried about it.
Do you still get that jolt of adrenaline, Artsia, after all these years? You've been doing this for 30 years or so, or not? Do you deal
absolutely.
With burnout?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've dealt with burnout a couple of times in my career. First time was really rough because I didn't know what I was going through. I just knew I was a bitter person and was really angry all the time. And good friends in the business kind of pulled me aside and said, you need to take some time off, which I did. And the second time, I recognized the symptoms myself, was able to pull out much sooner than let myself. And I think that that's healthy. It's healthy to understand that you can shoulder a lot of the world's problems and start taking things personally.
What was it that caused that burnout? What was it that put you in that place?
Well, if there was a singular moment during the second event, it was because of an assault that I was assaulted on the job. And the assault, without getting into a ton of details, was basically my partner and I having to fight our way out of a single room occupancy hotel room in San Francisco in the Mission District. And the door was locked, and we had done a lot of mistakes as we had entered into the building. At the moment when we were fighting, and literally the thoughts of one of the assailants had a weapon, and that one of us could actually die based in this fight.
And these were people you were called to help?
That's correct. We were there to help them, but and it really turned into – it was really much more of a criminal issue, a crime issue, as opposed to a medical issue. And a lot of times calls come cloaked like that. So you're caught off guard, and in trying to retreat, you can't retreat, and therefore you have to fight your way out. And during that fight, I was not seriously injured, but enough to put me out for 2 weeks.
And as I recall, if this is the story I'm thinking of, you were attacked by someone who was HIV positive.
That's correct. Yeah. The patient was a younger female who was actually working as a prostitute. And the boyfriend was actually the pimp. And they were doing their business in that room. And the night manager wanted them out. And so he was calling the police. And at that time, the police weren't really available. So then he called. The person was unconscious. And that's how we went. And in the process of waking them, the patient up, things just got out of hand extremely quickly. Within seconds, we went from, oh, this is an unconscious patient, to, oh, my God, we're fighting on the bed. And it took a long time. Most fights take, in reality, probably about 15 to 30 seconds. We really estimated it was probably about a 2 to 3 minute fight, where eventually it stopped because I had to kick the patient unconscious so that she would stop fighting. And my partner was grappling with the boyfriend, who was on top of me at the same time, trying to find something under the bed, which we felt was a weapon at the time.
And you then had to spend some weeks not knowing whether or not you were infected. Is that right?
Yeah. This was the mid-90s. And so we had started to really understand the transmission of AIDS, but it wasn't fully understood. And I was confronted with the concept of taking some of these heavy-duty cocktail drugs, which were sort of experimental at the time, and having to make decisions about, you know, my family, my wife, what risks do I take? And realizing at that moment that I had really risked the lives of my family, and that was very unnerving. And that at that point, it came to mind, as we kind of re-ran the calls in our head with my partner, Kevin, that that we were both in the phase of burnout, and it was time to move on.
And yet you're still doing this.
I'm still doing it. Absolutely. I think if you take time – so I think a lot of us who stay in the business for a while recognize when we start to get to that point, take some time off, reassure ourselves that we're just human. And so we will pick up a lot of stuff and we'll absorb a lot of that. Emotion that's involved, but you've got to get rid of it one way or the other.
Let's hear what some of our listeners would like to observe and comment on as part of our conversation. Deborah, you're on. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good morning. My husband had a heart attack in February, and he went into cardiac arrest in the ambulance. It was the paramedic that saved his life. And I'd never, fortunately, been in a situation like that. So I was really struck by how personal it is, your job is. I'm so grateful to hear your personal stories, because I think a lot of people are like me and don't really fully understand what it's like. But what struck me was that I naturally just wanted to thank him, give a shout out to Doug on Maui. And so I went down to the emergency room the next day and left my phone number. So if he wanted to, he could call me, because I'd heard he'd call the ICU to find out if my husband was okay, which he is. And so he called me and we got to talk, and we ended up actually having lunch with his family. And it's an amazing thing that you all do. I was stunned when he said they rarely hear from people. And so I wanted to kind of put that out to folks that, you know, maybe make it off an opportunity for you all to get the thanks and recognition that you deserve. And also to just say I was shocked by how dangerous driving the ambulance can be and how slow people are to respond. So I just hope more people would with when I hear a siren pull over, because it's not only a trauma for the patient and family, but also for, you know, for you all who are in the ambulance. Doug, the paramedic was sweating. He was working so hard on my husband to keep him alive.
Deborah, so, thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks for adding that. I think it's all very much appreciated. I can tell within the studio, you were all sort of applauding when she said, why don't people pull over?
It's dangerous. Out on that road, it's dangerous. And we put ourselves at risk when we put those lights and sirens on. We've had several fatality accidents involving ambulances in the last week. And as recently as this morning, we had an air helicopter go down. We lost three. At least in the street, it would be totally helpful for us if people on both sides of the road would just pull to the right and stop. Hmm. That's the law. And it helps us keep them safe. I don't think most people realize we're moving in a fire truck or engine, we're moving tens of tons of metal down the road at a relatively high speed. Those are not easy to control.
Thank you, Deborah, so much for your call. I'm guessing, Delia, that you would agree with Deborah about that people want to know what happens. Do you find yourself wanting to know what happens to people and appreciating it when someone like Deborah calls and says, thank you, and yes, my husband made it?
Definitely. And Deborah is definitely the rare gem of an exception. I work in a small community. Well, actually, geographically, it's a large community, but the population is small. So I get a little bit more feedback than many of my urban colleagues. And I love hearing outcomes. And it helps my medicine to be better as well. So I get pretty good feedback from the hospitals. I'll oftentimes ring the hospitals later and inquire after patient outcomes. And then I'll use the patient information sometimes to call them. But in the rare instances that I get a phone call myself or a card, it's amazing. It's really wonderful.
Rob joins us next from Santa Rosa. Rob, go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to touch base really quickly. I have been a professional athlete for years, and over the years, I've been first on scene to several really bad accidents, traumatic situations that I was able to help in that allowed, I guess in the end, I facilitated enough that people survived. And these situations over the years have given me enough of a push to decide to change careers, and am currently in the police academy and will be going through the fire and EMT academies here shortly. I can't quite describe what the feeling of satisfaction is when you can help, but it was significant enough to have me change careers.
Rob, thanks. Do you have to be a certain kind of person, do you think, to make that choice that Rob is making?
I'd like to say, you know, my unit has everyone from financial accountants to EMTs, doctors, nurses, but also engineers, business people. I think that from my perspective, what we do is a public service. What we care about is serving the public. I think that what matters to each and every person on my unit, and certainly to me personally, is that we can show up and help our community, whether it's in a small way or in a big way. And we've been talking a lot this hour about major life-saving ways, but the majority of them is in smaller, not life-saving ways. And those ways are important to me, just as important to me, and that keeps me going. I think that everyone has that inside of them. I, you know, applaud the caller for joining the police academy. I wish you the best of luck in your future career. But I think that what I would say is that, everyone does their part. You know, it's not just us and the paramedics. It's our dispatchers. It's the accountants who keep our rigs on the road or who, you know, help us stay a nonprofit. It's, you know, each person does their bit. Mm. And if what you can do for your community, if what inspires you is a food bank, that's great. And if it's this, that's great.
Yeah. It's such an interesting and good point, Kyle. When you hear sometimes on the news those 911 calls, and you realize what skill it takes to be a 911, to take those calls, to deal with them appropriately, and you can tell the difference that they can make. What have you learned in this profession, Dan Robertson, about human nature, I guess, about
you touched on diversity earlier, and I think we are incredibly diverse as an organism, the human condition and everything that entails. I think in order to be successful in this, in any of our careers, or to have any longevity in our careers, you really have to have that passion, and that desire to help people has to be in there. And I think that most people want to help.
And what have you learned about the people you help? What is the goodness, I guess, that you have seen? And what are the things that you just wish, like people pulling over when they see ambulance lights, that they would do?
I think people are really all the same, is what it comes down to. You know, I've been fortunate that I've traveled a little bit overseas as well. And we all have the same wants, and we all have the same desires. We want to be able to go through life and hope that our kids will be better off than we are. And we want to try to help people as we go through life. And I also think sometimes people can be incredibly selfish sometimes, you know, simply I'm the only one on the road. I don't care if there's a fire truck coming up behind me. I'm in a hurry, sort of thing like that. But I think deep down inside, all of us are, you know, we're programmed to care for each other and to try to help each other out.
What have you learned, Delia? What have you been exposed to? What's surprised you? What have you taken from your work that's given you a sense of the world, I guess, that you wouldn't have seen if you hadn't gone through this particular career?
What has changed in my worldview since becoming a paramedic that I wasn't expecting is that I have a much fuller awareness of the true depth of suffering experienced by the marginalized and disenfranchised in our world. Most of my friends lead pretty, quote, normal, end quote, whatever that is, lives. Most of them are housed. I'm from rural Humboldt County, and I never really considered myself to have been sheltered. And I've definitely seen a lot of austerity, and I've seen drug issues when I was growing up. But when you work in 911, you see depths of human suffering that are truly difficult to conceptualize. Just people who have unyieldingly bleak, difficult existences, people who have just crippling, debilitating illnesses that subject them to daily, chronic, unrelenting pain. We meet people who are not housed and suffer greatly in their life. We meet people who struggle with drug use and abuse. We meet survivors of catastrophically violent acts. And the main thing I didn't have in my worldview is a real resonating understanding of how much suffering there is out there below the surface.
And what can you give them in those moments, knowing that they will likely, that suffering will continue? What do you try to do in the moment that you have with them?
I try to have a soulful connection with the people that I care for, and I try to treat even the most marginalized, disenfranchised, troubled person with the amount of respect that's safe for me to do so. I mean, Art's touched upon this, but we definitely meet people who in their pain become kind of sketchy and unreliable in terms of what you can anticipate their actions being. But I always try to be honest with people, you know, even if I have to restrain somebody who's combative, I explain to them why I'm doing it, that it's not personal, you know, that I care for them as a human.
Some comments that people are writing in. This person writes, "My father was a fireman for over 20 years. It had a huge impact on our family. I think the hardest were those 24-hour shifts that created a dichotomy in our family. There was life with Dad and life without. On the lighter side, my mother once washed my dad's underwear with something red, turned into a lovely hue of pink. The guys at the station razzed him something awful." So on the impact of family, Artzia.
It is. It's funny because I think that you develop two families. And Dan mentioned this also a little bit earlier. And I think all of us have sort of mentioned in one way or the other, there's this we do have a sense of family and a sense of closeness because we occupy a pretty unique job position that sees a lot of things that most people would never see. And there's an unspoken part of that world that tends to stay within that world. So most of us probably don't carry our junk with us back home once we leave, and we try to keep it contained. I'm very fortunate. I've been married for a long time, 25 years, to my wife, who was also an EMT when she first started as a working adult. And she, although hasn't practiced in a long time, understands our world. And it's really great to have that. Your kids don't really ever understand what you do. They may idolize you and still have a lot of questions inside their head as they're growing up because you are gone for long periods of time.
But your dad finally gets it, right?
Yeah, I think my dad finally gets it. I know he's listening today as well as my mom, and I think they finally are figuring it out.
Let's hear next from Susan in San Rafael. Susan, go ahead.
I just want to say that years ago I understand now the compassion you folks all have. Our neighbor was ill, had young kids and a wife, and the call came. Everybody was kind of standing around watching, and when I saw the responders come out, I could read their body language, and he didn't make it. And it taught me a very good lesson about you people and your compassion, and I just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's
thank
it.
You.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you very much for calling. Patrick writes in, when the paramedics arrived, well, let me go back to his first paragraph. 10 years ago, a neighbor came banging on the door to tell us that her roommate was having a seizure. When the paramedics arrived, I was initially shocked at how calm and cool and slow-moving they were as they methodically assessed the scene and treated the patient. I was originally surprised by what seemed by a lack of urgency, but in the end, I realized that may have been the best way to handle those situations. Is that a really true statement?
That is so
absolutely
true.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Always say rescuers only run on television.
Yeah.
Or we'll make jokes like rescuers only run to the refrigerator.
Right. Or when the donuts are hot.
Yeah.
At an arrest, the first step is to take your own pulse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Marcia in Oakland is on with us next. Marcia, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Really, really appreciate your service. And I wanted to ask, sometimes there are a few minutes before you all can arrive and there's a passerby coming along to an accident. I'm wondering if you have any tips for what we can do or if you recommend courses.
Take a first aid.
Marcia,
class.
Thanks. Art, go ahead.
Absolutely. The first responder really is the bystander. And we may be the professional resources and we have the training, but as the caller just pointed out, there is often a period of time where if someone is seriously injured or is ill, there are simple steps that people can do that can preserve life.
Does it still surprise you how little probably most of us know? I've never taken a class, mm-hmm. I must now admit. Is that more common than you'd like that people just don't know what the basics?
Clearly, we know that if, for example, in cardiac arrest, the more of the public that knows how to do CPR, the higher the resuscitation rates. It's simple science. And I think there's moves now afoot to try to incorporate more of this into high school curriculum. Because if it becomes part of the requirement for like a health class, it becomes easier. And a lot of the tricks that we do, a lot of the tips that we can provide to people are super simple, like how to control major bleeding. If you could do that, we saw that at the Boston Marathon, mm-hmm. where many lives were saved by bystanders. Absolutely, any of the EMS folks that were there on scene have all said if they had not tied on tourniquets, many of those people would have died. And so simple things like that are easy to learn.
If possible, I'd like to quickly respond since it's come up twice with Rob and Marcia. I've had an instance that I can think of very clearly where a bystander saved a life. There was a vehicle that had rolled multiple times, and the person who had called 911 had, prior to our arrival, gone in and gotten the one accessible person, and she was unconscious, and he was kind of cradling her in his arms, kind of supporting her in a semi-standing up vertical position. And fire in that area, the fire department was very delayed. So it's because it's volunteer out there. So we beat them, and we have one tiny little fire extinguisher. And by our arrival, the vehicle was completely engulfed in flames. And that one person, that the bystander, was able to just get out of the vehicle. And he risked his own life in doing that. I don't know if he was aware. And I kind of wish I could go back in time and thank him properly. So, you know, Rob, thank you, since I wasn't able to thank that one person. But by being willing to go to a vehicle that might explode, going to it and getting her, you know, I don't know if it was a calculated decision or if it was just something this bystander did, but I'm grateful, even though at the time I just grabbed the patient and took off.
We just have a moment left, and I think everyone listening, and I too certainly want to join in thanking you for all that you do. So just tell us once more about what it is about this profession that you have chosen in your experience that keeps you there briefly. Kyle?
I think that I can't imagine a life without Mountain Rescue. It's completely reshaped my entire life. And I think I stand for two things. One is that the Bay Area Mountain Rescue Unit is my family. Those people are extremely close to me and our community. We keep each other strong. And I think the other thing is I believe passionately in public service, and I believe passionately in that missing people should be reunited with their families, and that will make me wake up at any time of night in any situation, and that will keep me going.
Art?
It is the opportunity to serve. I think the desire to help people. I feel totally blessed that I have an opportunity to help people, no matter how little that might be, but just to do something that helps alter whatever is going on with them for the positive. And on the very rare occasion where my actions make a difference in outcome in terms of living or dying, those are absolutely joyous occasions.
Dan?
It's never boring. I love the passion and the excitement and the challenges it brings out in me. And I'm thankful for the opportunity to help and the opportunities it's given me.
Delia, last word.
It's a deep honor to share with people their oftentimes worst day and to render whatever aid is possible. My shiftmates are wonderful. The job is wonderful. And it's just a big honor. I agree with everybody. It's an honor to serve.
It's an honor to have you all here. Thank you all so much. Dan Robertson, Art Sia, Kyle Barber, Delia Stoltz. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Howard Gelman, our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.